You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is March 3rd, 2021. As always, I want to thank my donors and my friends. As our struggle gets worse and worse as time goes on, this kind of support for all of us who are fighting this battle full time is essential. Not just support for me personally, but also for Radio Albion. And I want to mention Sven Longshanks. I don't think a lot of people realize the huge amount of work that this now very large network requires. He's doing almost all the work himself. He is doing it with very little money, very little support, and the hours are very long. And it's that kind of work ethic under constant attack from the regime that requires our support. And if you can't do it financially, at least rhetorically. If one of our people are being attacked, whether it be Facebook or YouTube, don't avoid it. Say something in support, even if it's in the most general sense. And that's extremely important today. We really have no institutions. Last week we talked about the concept of narcissism, both as a psychological idea, which is simple enough, and its relationship to the regime. The regime, as I've defined many times before, is a very technical term that I use all the time. It refers to how power, the locus of power. The regime is a nexus, almost a matrix of both private and public sources of authority. It hits everything from, medicine to media to academics to manufacturing to politics, of course, in all senses of the term, international. And it's a relatively small group of people, extremely wealthy, who finance everything from NGOs to universities to hospitals. The people who you see in the list of the Bilderberg meetings, they come from all walks of life, but they have a few things in common. They're liberal politically, every last one in a very broad sense. They are millionaires or billionaires. They are very isolated from ordinary people. Many of them are, in fact, narcissists and self-absorbed. They're very disturbed people in the sense that they're never going to get enough. The power that they have is never going to be enough. If that were the case, they would simply take the billions they have and just retire. But they won't. It's never enough. And ultimately, these are very unhappy people. And I say it because no matter how much power they get, no matter how much coercive power that they're able to collect, it's never enough. They're never finished. They're always on the warpath for something. They're always disordered. They're always covering something up. And ultimately, it comes down to the fact that things can change very quickly. I use the example all the time of the Soviet Union. One day, roughly between 1989 and 1990, this huge colossus fell to pieces. There was not a war. There was no the economic or otherwise. The U.S. was, you know, trading as it always did freely with Gorbachev's empire. And one day, all of a sudden, people noticed that the system was simply dissolving. Now we can talk about the causes for that, but it's all post hoc kind of reasoning. But last week we dealt with the fact that we're dealing with people who aren't just incorrect. They're not just wrong factually. There's something wrong with them. We live in an age of mass censorship where, and again, as I said, it's never enough. They are now openly talking about the destruction of anyone they disagree with. They're talking about the almost ritual humiliation of anyone that disagrees with them in even a fairly minor area. They're constantly on the lookout. They're constantly reading things and reading into things. The recent controversy, the Dr. Seuss books. Dr. Seuss was a leftist, of course. But the point is, or the author of those books, but there's no real specific reason for this. They're doing it just to do it. They're doing it just to let everyone know that they're capable of this kind of evil. Amazon just went through another mass purge. But you would think to yourself, given the power that they have, given the, you know, almost unequaled authority over others that they have, why are they so fanatical about this? What they're doing doesn't exactly come from people who are secure in their power. But again, using the Soviet example, they're never secure. Psychologically, they're aware that they have no right to rule, that they have no right, they haven't earned any of the money or the power that they have. No one could possibly earn, you know, trillions of dollars. They know that their regime can fall at any moment. No one really has faith in it. The economy is not going to recover. There's no foundation for it to recover because there's no manufacturing. There's no credit. They're aware of this. They're also aware that the bulk of the population, really of all races today, rejects the major media. The major media is their number one source of power. Right now, without control of the media, they have nothing. This is what we do here, why it's so important. And because they realize that this can, you know, go wrong at any moment, they are getting more and more fanatical. Last week, we talked about narcissism, not just as a psychological phenomenon, but both as a spiritual one and a political one. As I said before, psychology is a very, very weak field. Psychology used to be a philosophical discipline up until, you know, the late Enlightenment. The social sciences essentially take the two master disciplines, which are philosophy and history. Everything comes from those two. You know, theology is on top because it's the ultimate purpose of everything. It can't go beyond God. And then the two master secular fields are philosophy and history. Everything, every field, every thought comes from both of those, because even historical studies have to have a philosophical background. They have to have a set of axioms that they start from. And philosophy is always historical. It has to start in a specific time and place and have topics to deal with that are important at the time. So in many ways, it's really one field. These are the two master fields. What the social sciences try to do is take a piece of this, make it fully quantitative. that is to say reduced to numbers, and make the claim, the epistemological claim, that that's what reality is. And you'll have positivists today that will say, if something is not operationalizable, that is reducible to numbers, or quantitative, it does not exist. That's the old scientific fallacy. Science can only deal with things that are based on physical cause and effect. Otherwise, they have no right to have an opinion on anything. Therefore, they say, well, because we have no power over it, it must not exist. We talked about narcissism last time in both of those senses. We talked about how extremely important it is to understand it psychologically and how it manifests itself politically. One of the most important things to take from what we did last week is to understand that every so-called symptom, these aren't symptoms in the medical sense by any means, but every symptom that you see in the narcissistic personality has its almost immediate, it's not an analog, because these aren't analogies, they are actually, you know, equal in terms of their reality. These, you know, we're not just using words here. They have a political equivalence. So, for example, your typical narcissistic person believes themselves to be special. They believe themselves to be worthy of some kind of admiration for some set of reasons. That set of reasons, those reasons have to be false. I mean, if you're a genius and no one pays any attention to you, will you have a right to be angry? The narcissist, because it's a pathology, can't be a genius. He just has to think he is, or want you to think he is, which is more important. And therefore, they deserve special treatment, and they're simply extraordinary people, and you really have to just learn from them, and they shouldn't really even be dealing with commoners. And the regime is the exact same way. They believe themselves to be the end of history, as the Marxists thought. One of the many connections between capitalism and Marxism is that they both believe, and they're very similar ideologies, capitalism and Marxism believe that they're at the end of history, that they are the solution to all the problems of the Enlightenment. Because of that, they have almost a theological right to rule. The problem with these kind of myths, the stories that they tell themselves, is that at some level, outside of the sociopath, because they have no connection there. They don't have any conscience. But the narcissist does have a conscience. It's deeply buried. And the conscience, as I've said, says that this is all nonsense. There's that famous debate that we've had for decades now. Do these people really believe this crap? Or is it just very lucrative for them to believe this crap? And then over time, they start believing their own press. For the most part, that's not entirely relevant. The people who we deal with every day, that's a different story. And that's what the regime, that's why it does what it does. They tell themselves a story. It's a false narrative that they tell themselves over and over again. They censor anything that doesn't fit. And therefore, they give themselves this ridiculous right to rule. Another trait is exploitation. Because the narcissistic personality doesn't recognize the reality of other people. They have no conception of what they do to people. They have no really ability to understand how they make people suffer. And what difference does it make if they have this, you know, status, you know, they're Superman. They're the Nietzschean Overman. And the regime is the exact same way. They don't know, they don't care, and they have no particular interest in how they have destroyed things. You know, the handful of Jewish economists that destroyed the Russian economy from 1990 to 1995, most of them are still around. They teach at Ivy League schools. They're put on TV. They're called the most, you know, laudatory names. And yet these people are really genocidal maniacs who caused the complete destruction and disintegration of an entire economy, such as it was. Harvard University, the economics department, we've been through this before. They have no conception of what they've done. Today, of course, because of censorship, it's really hard to get objective information. But even if they had it, it really doesn't matter. What frightens them, though, is that when we bring it up, and we bring it up over and over again, they know that we're out here. They know that we're doing this. And that's why they behave the way they do. That's why they freak out over the slightest deviation. The narcissistic personality is very much like that. So you have, you know, someone says a very mild criticism of the Jewish people, and they say, you want to put us in the ovens. This hysterical overreaction is a classic symptom of the narcissistic personality, because they're so fragile. Their position is fragile. Their ego is fragile. They're on the verge of breakdown at any given moment mentally because they of this cognitive dissonance. They'll react to even the slightest criticism of their world, of their self-image, with hysterical denunciation. There you have a very clear connection between the narcissistic mind and the regime. What exists in soul, this disorder there, manifests itself in the disorder of the regime. This is one of the key Platonic axioms of political science. But we ended last week dealing with how we approach these people. And I was talking specifically about debating them. Today, that's getting more and more difficult, partially because we're really not allowed to do that. The regime has full control over all social media, and you have bots and actually real people scouring comments and debates for anything that may be counter-revolutionary. The Soviet Union did not have this level of technological surveillance. It really was pretty mild by comparison. Debating these people, the so-called flying monkeys we talked about last week, is getting more and more difficult because for a bunch of reasons. Reason number one, logic and reason are coming under attack. That these are white male creations, including mathematics. There was a headline, 2 + 2 = 4 is racist because this comes from white European mathematics. You've seen this before. American Renaissance covers this stuff all the time. Reason, even the most basic empirical thought processes are under attack. If you have, number two, you have the absolute truth, as they all believe that they do, why be logical? Just, these people need to be silenced, need to be sent off to camps, they need to be, lose their jobs, whatever. And no one's going to say anything to them when they do it. Number three, education now is so poor that even, the teachers at all levels have no conception of reason. They can't define it. They don't know what it is. They know logic, maybe. But ask them for, a list of informal fallacies, and they don't know what you're talking about. They'll report you to the FBI, which they are doing. They do it all the time. So when you have logic and reason coming under attack, which, by the way, is a narcissistic trait. We talked about gaslighting. The notion that the very cognitive process that you use to argue with them, that will come under attack. They'll throw so much at you, emotion, threats, all with a smirk on their face, knowing full well that their power is behind them, and even claiming to be victims as I threaten you with losing everything. Almost with the notion that they want you to do something. They want you to lash out because you can't do under any circumstances. But I want to talk briefly about some of their techniques. We talked about it a little bit last week. Some of the fallacies that these, or really frauds that these people use, and it comes down to diversionary tactics. We talked about, you know, gaslighting. We talked about projection. The nonsense, the so-called word salad, the circular conversations. And then, of course, there's also, you know, blanket statements and wild generalizations. And it comes down to simple laziness. Again, if the entire regime is on your side, why even bother to think? These people are very soft. And because they're very soft, they can afford to, you know, throw out these ridiculous generalizations. They'll use terms like, you know, white supremacists or whatever. They don't know what it means. They couldn't define it. But they've been told they actually believe that this is somehow evil, whatever definition they have in their mind. And everyone who disagrees with them will be smeared with that brush, so don't worry about it. This is the very definition of toxicity. And the only thing you could do here is keep yourself focused on the point. Don't allow them to distract. And these are all diversionary tactics. Understand that they're being illogical. They're also trying to get a rise out of you. They're trying to get you to be angry, to do something. But I'm telling you now, the first person to lose their temper is the one who lost. If you stay cool, even if you don't know as much as the other person, you keep your cool, you stay calm, eventually they're going to lose it. It's really hard to have a social media debate within two or three responses. It's already personal and angry. People simply don't know how to think. They'll deliberately misrepresent you, and they'll do it to the point of absurdity. They'll repeat your, this happens quite often. If you give an argument of any complexity, they're going to tend to, probably won't understand it. Then what they're going to do is simply repeat it back to you themselves and then to you in a way that they understand. And in addition to that, they'll repeat it in a way that makes it seem ridiculous. I, to this day, continue to overestimate the mental ability of the people who I debate. They simply don't know how to make a basic logical argument. And of course, they know that to some extent, and they'll project it. I mean, they'll go even to the point where you're making points, and they'll say something like, oh, you must be perfect then. Oh, I must be a bad person. Everything I'm saying is wrong. Trying to read your mind, which is, by the way, one of the weakest forms of argument. Oh, you're just jealous kind of talk. They use a lot of mental health phrases. That you're obsessed with something, or that you're paranoid. That's the old Soviet technique of delegitimizing somebody by claiming that they're mentally ill. That's an old Soviet technique. And of course, they had mental hospitals that were filled to the brim of normal people who disagree with this. This is almost identical here. The prisons are absolutely bursting. There's not a big difference between the Soviet camps and these prisons. If you've ever even seen them, most people haven't even seen them. Another technique that they'll use all the time is nitpicking. They realize that they're being outclassed. Again, they probably have never heard your point of view before. And then they'll pick something, maybe a misspelling, they'll misspick a very minor logical lapse or something like that. The sociopathic moving the goalpost fallacy. Something silly. If you point to the fact that you may be successful in some area, they'll point to someone who's more successful. They'll constantly move the goalpost. Try to make you feel that you're not enough. Going after your morale, your sense of self is extremely common. You've all noticed the TV commercials have very, very few white people in them. What makes me laugh is that most of these are for products, you know, advanced computers or pickup trucks that have almost zero, say black or purchasing. You know, these expensive gaming systems and laptops and you know, classic, you know, white nerd kind of thing. They have all these black models in the ad. That is not their market. Well, since it's not their market, then what are they using them for? Other than sheer protection money. This is not what they have to do. I saw a commercial just today, in fact. The first time I saw a white man in a commercial in probably 3-4 days. It was a guy who was a father. It was an SUV commercial. And he was terrified, standing on the bumper of his SUV, because there was a little animal. I forget what it was, but it was tiny. It was making fun of the guy. It's like George Costanza type. So I guess they do have white males in ads, just that one. The point there is to humiliate. Keep in mind something very important. The regime, the people who control the press, advertising, entertainment, they're already multi-billionaires. That's, you know, they're good no matter what happens. They have other sources of income other than what it is that they're dealing with. You know, people who control the media, handful of people, mostly Jewish, they have other sources of income. They're invested all over the world in different things. The point is, they're willing to lose billions of dollars. Now, I've been saying this for, if you remember the Disney series, Nothing Sacred, about these corrupt Catholic priests. I was back in college, in fact. I remember Rush Limbaugh talking about that. And Brent Bozell from the Media Research Center. I remember Brent, in fact, talking about that it's that no one watched it. In fact, they couldn't even get advertisers for it. They were using those, you know, these local ads, these idiots, you know, car lots, whatever. And no one quite understood it because we're all taught to believe that these people just care about money and viewership and they'll do whatever, you know, their market wants. That's not the case. By now, most of you have read about the Golden Globes. Thank God, their viewership this year was down 60%. The NFL, again, thank God, is collapsing. Another couple of years, they won't be able to. The salary cap's going to kill them. Now, I don't really follow, but it's very clear when they don't have much of it, you know, the old income stream. But it doesn't matter. They're aware that people are abandoning them. They're aware that whenever they bring in the propaganda, whenever they force that down people's throats, it could be NASCAR, it doesn't matter. People leave. Not just white people. The Golden Globes had a 60% decrease. Saturday Night Live, that used to be my favorite show of all time, at least a few years ago, lost 40% of their viewers over the Trump stuff and everything else. They're to the point now where they actually they're doing skits, which are actually ads for products, and it's built in to the skit itself. They're so low on funds that they have to do stupid things like that. You can't tell the difference now between a show and advertising, which is, by the way, the wave of the future here. You'll see an episode of something, and you'll see a few products mentioned all the time, and you see the name, whatever it might be. It could be a car, it could be a food product. And what's happening is that they're paying for their loss of viewership through product placement. Now, again, that doesn't last long. The point is, they're willing to lose money. They're willing to go bankrupt. Not themselves, of course. It doesn't matter if they do or not. They have so many sources of income, and they have so much hidden away in banks all over the world. What difference does it make? They could drive themselves into a media company to the ground. They have almost an infinite amount of resources to keep it going. They're willing to lose money. Now, how that's going to hold for the future, this is a short-term strategy, of course. What's going to happen in the future, I don't know. Using, you know, advertisements as actual shows and drama and comedy. The line now is gone. That's probably a short-term strategy. And if there's no one watching, then the advertisement doesn't do much. They evade accountability. They use every kind of threat imaginable. Name-calling is simple, but it's very common. They, with something called destructive conditioning, where they will associate your strengths, your abilities, even good memories. They'll associate it with abuse, with frustration, with contempt. They will attack, you know, qualities that they once celebrated. They'll ruin, you know, celebrations, holidays. You see this in relationships. You see it in the regime by taking, you know, trying to keep the retail significance of Christmas just without mentioning Christmas in it. Isolating friends and family. All of this stuff. What the narcissist type does at the personal level, the regime is doing every day at the political level. Over time, you're trained to become afraid of doing even the most basic things. And without money, it's going to be more and more difficult to function at any level. So even the little things that we took for granted are now under attack. And of course, if all else fails, they use smear campaigns. They will keep us under surveillance. But there's also the concept, and this comes up quite often, what's called love bombing. Now, that's on a personal level. Where the excessive flattery. You may see an officially sponsored, vaguely conservative persona that suddenly will get all this adulation because once in a while he may say something kind of edgy. Nothing too bad, but once in a while. And when that happens, your response will be that, well, maybe things aren't so bad. This guy's going. This guy seems he's not being censored. Now, this is simply how it works. It exists on the personal level. It exists on the level of the regime. I'm wondering if Elon Musk is now being positioned to put in that category. On the other hand, someone like him can be the foundation of a new movement. I mean, they're oligarchs. They're just, even, you know, Trump is an oligarch. I mean, they're distorted to begin with. To be at that level. But because they're extremely strong personalities, you anger them enough. And I don't know what they're capable of. The regime, however, has just a huge number of weapons. So the fallacies that they use, the methods that they use, you have to be aware of all of this. You have to be able to see it, identify it, and then, in fact, call it out. Fallacies are extremely important. Most of you know what a straw man is. The straw man is one of the most important techniques that the regime uses. They're even to the point now where they're doing it in academic journals. It's when they create a caricature of your point of view. As I mentioned before, they'll repeat back your point of view in a distorted way. They'll exaggerate it. They really make a character of the whole thing. And then that's what they attack. So, for example, they really believe that any criticism of illegal immigration or any immigrant, you know, America doesn't need any immigrants. Illegal immigration is another diversion. All immigration is a problem right now. There's no need for another immigrant in history from here on in the U.S. There's absolutely no need for them. So the illegal distinction is that's a, you know, neocon diversion. But they'll take even the celebrity. When Donald Trump first ran for office in 2016, his criticism of illegal immigration was no different than Bill Clinton's in the 90s. He was very calm and moderate. But they created a caricature. They created a straw man. They created a Donald Trump that doesn't actually exist. They'll create the guy. They'll provide him with all kinds of ridiculous opinions. They'll invent stories. They'll have all kinds of manipulated photographs. They'll call him every name imaginable because it's all based, according to them, on blind hate. There's no good reason to be opposed to their agenda. Jewish oligarchy, immigration, the migrant invasion in Europe over the last few years. There's no good reason to reject that. Therefore, it's blind hate. And that's the caricature that they'll actually approach in your day-to-day life. Those supporting the regime see you that way. And as mass censorship becomes more and more common, and, you know, is more and more institutionalized, these people actually won't know any better. They'll see you as someone who's, by their own estimation, demented. How does this guy not see that to be opposed to the system is insanity? Liberalism right now doesn't see themselves as an ideology. They see themselves as reality. That's been going on for some time. But the higher you go up the scale of power, the more and more isolated they are. This was the case in the Soviet Union too, that elite party members rarely came across any other idea, any other concept, or any other person. I mean, the oligarchical families usually only marry each other. They're deeply inbred. They're entirely and completely isolated, even genetically so, from people on the ground. So it's not a matter of believing a liberal point of view because they compare it with everything else. They believe it because they don't know anything else. It's not, you know, the idea of, say, the isolated individual or, mass immigration, Jewish oligarchy. These things are not only, it's not a matter of principle debate. That's simply how it is. Right-wingers are insane, mental case white supremacists. And they have this emotional response to that. You question the Judaic Holocaust, you're psychotic, who needs to be put in prison. And they do say that. They say it all the time. Denying that, or rejecting it, or even questioning it is illegal in most countries of Europe right now. They think that this isn't a matter of debate. They think that's simply how it is. That's a brute fact. You have to be absolutely essential. This is absolutely essential for you. You have to be very much aware of this. And because they think that liberalism is reality, not one point of view among others, they don't see any need to do anything other than appeal to authority. Equivocation, appeals to popularity, what they think is popularity. The appeal to ignorance, for example. And, of course, as always, the appeals to emotion, you know, pity or affection, question begging, the false dilemma. So a false dilemma, for example, in the Holocaust stuff, they'll say, either, you know, you reject the notion of this, you know, Jewish genocide on the one hand, or you totally accept it. Black or white, nothing in between. So you have to deny camps, you have to deny any reference to Jews in official pronouncements. You have to deny the existence of any forced labor camp anywhere, as opposed to somewhere in the middle, where you're questioning the dogma, but not necessarily at every single level. Of course, lots of Jews were killed. Of course, camps existed, but certainly not in the way that they say, and not for the reasons that they say. But the minute you start getting details, even something like that, gets too complicated. You start going down that path in front of them. They see that you're making a good argument. You're doing it calmly. You're doing it rationally. to defend themselves, they're going to insert a thought-stopping cliche. Oh, this guy's just a white supremacist, whatever the slogan is at the moment. That's designed not to shut you up, but to shut their own thought process up. And it goes on and on. A slippery slope is a big fallacy. Hasty generalization. Faulty analogies. Or even the idea that just because the logic in an argument might be false, therefore the conclusion is false, which is not necessarily the case. One after another, and these come from the decay of education, the decay of basic thought. When your point of view is conflated with reality, it's not even a point of view, it's just how things are. If you have the power of the regime behind you in every way, why are you going to study something? It used to be that the regime would talk about relativism. Relativism is college freshman, the most ridiculous, lazy, it's the negation of thought. Because the minute you start thinking that, moral behaviors are relative, they're not really good, they're not really bad, they might be useful or not useful, but that's it, then why worry about it? If there's no consensus, or even the ability to know doesn't exist, why worry about it? Why would you study something that there's no truth to, or truth is impossible? Now that's gone. In the 80s, 90s, relativism was the liberal point of view. That is gone. Now they are promoting the most intense absolutism down to the slightest detail of your behavior. Every move you make is under regime surveillance, because every move you make can lead you in court. Liberalism is totalitarian, as Alexander Dugin says, because it's based on capital, it's based on conglomerates, it's based on oligarchy, and because of the conflation of public and private sources of power, there is nothing that you can do or say that isn't amenable to regulation. Because private and public have collapsed, that distinction doesn't exist anymore. You don't have a single source of power. One of the great absurdities, and there's so many of them, but one of the great ones is that only governments are capable of repressing somebody. Now, if the private sector can destroy your livelihood, can shut down your bank account, as they're doing now, take away your credit cards, as they did with the Barnes Review not too long ago, shut down your books at Amazon, whatever it might be, that's probably more effective than a prosecution from the state. There's no presumption of innocence. There's no procedure. There's no court case. They simply cut you off. And they've destroyed livelihoods by the thousands solely on the basis of not being immediately conformist in every respect. And I mean in every respect. To be one of our people in a powerful position right now has got to be terrifying. Because the slightest deviation will get you removed. And this is an unfortunate fact. We talk about narcissism, and it's something that is worth discussing. The story itself, the story of Narcissus and Echo. Narcissus, I should say. An Echo from Ovid, the Metamorphoses, the third book. It doesn't get discussed all that much, especially by psychologists who don't even know where this stuff really came from. When you they do all the time when they describe something like this, something out of their field is usually disaster area. It's just, three or four lines trying to summarize what happened. But it goes to show that this stuff has been around long before the social sciences were. It's just stated in a different way. The ancients were far more rational in their understanding of psychology than today, which is completely dominated by psychology and all the social sciences, especially economics. Narcissus comes from really the primal god, Cephisius, the river god, which is a very primal entity, and a nymph, Liriope. That's his parent. By the way, he's a result of rape. Liriope was raped by the river god, at least by most of the versions of the story. So you already have problems even before the story begins. Now, Liriope brings baby Narcissus to Tiresias, who shows up all over the place in Greek mythology, and already at a very young age is extraordinarily attractive. People can't get their eyes off the guy. And because the nymph, his mother, is worried about this, is very interested in the destiny that this guy has, brings him to Tiresias, and Tiresias says, and the translations differ here, if he but fail to recognize himself, a long life he may have beneath the sun. Which at the time was seen as a very odd, Ovid calls it frivolous. Some translations say, not recognize himself, but know himself. If he doesn't recognize himself, if he doesn't know himself, he'll be okay. And so you start off with the rape, you start off with the primal background of the river god being this primal urge, of course, and a nymph as a mother. You already have problems. And we'll see here in a minute that the entire concept of Narcissus and Echo is based on a lack of communication. Now, of course, this is pure foreshadowing. Echo is the nymph. Is a nymph that Narcissus meets. So there's nymphs all over the place. Nymphs are also very primal. They're very close to their job. Essentially, is to flower natural beauty, to take the wild beauty of things outside of civilization, which is already an issue, and make it beautiful. They're all female, and they're all considered very, very attractive. Narcissus is also a hunter. Many of you know the symbolism of the hunter. The hunter is almost always a negative stereotype in ancient literature. Nimrod, the founder of Babylon, was a hunter. These are people who are extremely aggressive. They're constantly searching for material goods. And just like the regime we talked about before, they're never happy. Because material goods, they come to be, they pass away. It's temporarily pleasurable, and then it goes away. The need doesn't stop. And you get used to it, and then you want more. That's what the hunter is associated with. The hunter is almost always male, and is obsessed with power, absolutely obsessed with power. So this is what Narcissus becomes. He meets Echo, another nymph, a nymph that prior to meeting Narcissus never stopped talking. Echo became somewhat famous among the gods because when Jupiter was engaged in his well-known extramarital affairs, Echo would distract Juno or Hera, Zeus's or Jupiter's wife. Echo's job was to kind of keep her occupied so Zeus can get out of there, wherever he is, to go out the back door. So Echo's job was to protect Zeus rhetorically for his adultery. So again, we barely started the story. and you have primal irrational urges, you have rape, and now you have adultery. We haven't even started here. Now, Hera, of course, the mother of the gods, the matron god, goddess, the goddess of the family, especially as people get older, curses Echo. Once she realizes what she's doing, she curses her in a very eccentric way. The curse is to be able only to repeat the last few words of what someone else says. So if someone says a sentence, the only way she could respond, either to repeat it or at least the second half of it. Juno says, "Your tongue, so freely wagged at my expense, shall be of little use, your endless voice much shorter than your tongue." And then the nymph was stricken. The nymph is a female spirit, the female spirit of the natural world. Goddesses, the very minor goddesses of the forest, rivers, whatever, meadows. And again, they have a very primal center. They've been around as long as anything's been around. You even see, like in, Hesiod talks about, deriving from, Uranus and Cronus. The nymphs are very, very ancient. And I mentioned the primal entity here, the primal origin, because these lusts, these drives, aren't rational. They're beyond reason. They're immediate. Of course, reason is strictly mediated. But Narcissus, to continue the story, grew up almost being worshipped by people. His attractiveness, which as far as we can tell is really only physical, is so extraordinary that he himself becomes very arrogant about it. The center of the story is that he comes to believe that the only that the people aren't worthy of him, and he's searching as a hunter for someone worthy of him to love. Even the most beautiful nymphs aren't good enough, including Echo. And Ovid talks about the pathless woods. He's out of civilization, where only the primal urges exist. He's a hunter, and as always, they're searching for things. Echo, the nymph, falls in love with him very quickly. And as Narcissus is hunting, he notices her or hears something, and he would say something like, "Who's there?" And because of the curse, Echo would just say, "There," or "Here." So when Narcissus says, "Come here," all she could say in return is, "Come here." "Please don't avoid me." And she says, "Don't avoid me." It sounds like she's playing with him in a good way, that she's being flirty, so to speak. So now you're outside of civilization, so you're in a primal area with people who are, they're the way they are, either from rape or adultery, based entirely on what we call the brain stem, like a zombie, motivated entirely by the lower drives. And when you look like Narcissus did, this mostly goes for women, but in this case, it goes for him too. You don't really have to worry about much. He got whatever he needed. But this connection between Echo and Narcissus is based on a total lack of communication. Neither one of them has any... First of all, neither one of them knows really anything but themselves. They've never known rejection. They've never really had to communicate. A beautiful woman really doesn't have to do much in her life. She gets whatever she wants, whenever she wants it. They don't have to be smart. They don't have to be nice. They don't have to be anything. They simply have to exist. So you have people who are self-absorbed, the very fact that Echo was involved in trying to cover for Zeus's extramarital affairs shows you what that's all about. Zeus simply using these people. But what Narcissus is noting here is that this girl's interesting. She has no idea what, you know, the curse or anything else. And Echo finally sees him, and according to Ovid, tries to fling herself at him, throw her arms around him, and he gets angry. And he says, "Get your hands off me. I'd rather die than someone like you ever come near me." And then in return, she says, "Come near me." The last three words of what he said. So he can't make any sense of what she's doing. It sounds like she's really needy. "I'd rather die than be connected with you." And she says, "Connected with you. I want to be with you." You know, so the whole thing is based on total misunderstanding. Words and phrases are being used not to convey information, but to manipulate. Or in this case, because she's being forced to mirror him. Mirroring is very important. Because, you know, think of politicians trying to sound like the common man, trying to sound like they're in tune with what people think. They mirror the traits of what they think the common man is, the union man is, the working man is, whatever. And they usually sound ridiculous doing it. But that's what's happening here. But again, she's not worthy of him. She's not perfect. And therefore, he not only rejects her, but does it in a contemptuous way. Then Echo goes to Nemesis, also a female, the goddess that deals with revenge for people with power who don't deserve it, people who have good fortune without working, people who live according to their looks, like Narcissus does, people who have illegitimate power and wealth. People who collect rents, to use the formal term. Echo, now she's been cursed. She's been rejected by this guy. She's obsessed with this guy very quickly, believing that my fulfillment as a nymph isn't in the fact that I'm a nymph or that I work for Zeus at one point. No, it's this guy. Her entire personhood is based around having this man. And when she's rejected, she goes to Nemesis. And Nemesis takes her case, apparently. And that's where the famous part where he comes across the pool of water. And we all know what happens. And for the most part, interpretations of the story, sometimes it's ambiguous, but of course this has been told several times by others too. Obviously it's most important. It's not clear if Narcissus is aware who he's looking at. In fact, generally speaking, the consensus is that he has no idea. In the medieval version of the story, he thinks it's a woman in there. All mental illnesses are based on delusion. Believing something's there when it's not, or vice versa. It's unclear what Narcissus sees when he sees himself in the pool. He's not really seeing the actual reflection like we would see because of the curse of Nemesis, but just also because of his personality in general. He sees an ideal projection of what he thinks he is. The curse just keeps him there. Just like Echo put her entire identity into having this guy, Narcissus then puts his entire identity into this reflection. Turns out that the reflection is just nothing more than a projection of what Narcissus thinks the perfect person is. He's not aware that it's actually him, though. Jung makes a big deal about this. So you add the foundations of the story, the rape, the adultery, the manipulation, the worst aspects of civilization, then you take that outside of civilization, because they meet each other in the woods. With no, it says, actually, he says pathless woods. Civilization is not there. Without civilization, there's no language. There's no real communication. But they were not capable of it anyway. Echo is not capable of communicating, really. But neither is Narcissus. But they're both searching for something. Narcissus especially. He's been alone his entire life. In fact, it's hinted that he's a virgin. Because he won't touch anybody. No one is good enough. One of the worst aspects of this disease, this now institutionalized condition. Same thing goes for anxiety and depression, all these issues. The person suffering here doesn't really see external reality. External reality is a projection of their distorted minds. It doesn't take genius to see the connection with how the regime functions. You don't get to that level of power and wealth, an overwhelming coercive ability, a power that we couldn't even dream of, and end up being a normal person. They're not. They are amoral at best. It's unclear whether or not Narcissus is aware that he can't leave, because he eventually simply, you know, fades away. Same thing for Echo. They both essentially fade away to nothing. Later versions of the story have Cupid as the one who, you know, puts the golden arrow into Echo, which, of course, is, again, irrational desire. The fact that Narcissus comes from the river god is extremely important because, again, that's sub-rational drives. This is where the mental illnesses come from. None of these people are actually seeing reality. Echo comes to the point where she thinks that her entire world only matters and only really can come to fruition if she has him, having seen him only, you know, just briefly. But then to be rejected with that level of contempt. So both of these people are completely, they're not, both of these people are deeply flawed. The regime sees us as a projection of their own illness. They don't see people. They don't see opposition. They see us like the Soviets saw their opposition. Dangerous, unpredictable, and by no means should be given any kind of representation. They deserve, at best, a trip to the mental institution. Which is going to start happening because you have these constant drives to paint everyone as crazy. You've been called every mental illness name, you know, schizo, whatever, bipolar. And you're usually the first thing they say half the time. Believing in a so-called conspiracy theory means that there's something wrong with you mentally. These are, of course, both projections and deflections. But that's something they're not capable of. They're not capable of understanding. That's how the regime sees us. Narcissus sees himself in the pool as a projection of everything he thinks a lover should be. It's not real. Yes, he's seeing himself in his own attractiveness, but he doesn't know that. He sees this ideal projection of everything that finally there's somebody worthy of me. So it's not a matter of arrogance. I mean, besides the fact that he was cursed, it's a matter of the fact that the power that his status gave him, just like how the oligarchy functions today, that level of power has destroyed any ability for these people to have a normal relationship with somebody. They only associate with each other. In Narcissus' case, there's only one person. It's almost like he deliberately split himself into two so he could finally have some kind of relationship, even though, I mean, he tries to hug it, he tries to grab it, and of course it's water. And somehow, the curse breaks down his cognitive ability. The parallels are so clear here. that the ancients understood. To some extent, narcissists may represent the senatorial elite. Ovid tended to support, you know, a monarchy. As, you know, the author of the Aeneid, I should say, did. And this is one of the reasons that they became so famous. And so they saw this arrogance. The oligarchy is clearly reflected here, I think, no pun intended. And this is just the very beginning. Now we've come to the end of the hour here. I didn't quite get to everything I wanted to do, but I think my point has been made very clearly. We're not dealing with a principled debate here. It's not a matter of someone has the facts and someone doesn't. It's deeper than that. At the elite level anyway, and even otherwise, those supporting liberalism, which is not an ideology, but it is the regime, intellectually speaking, don't even understand what we think. They've never heard it. They don't want to hear it. Even people specializing in allegedly what we do, university professors, really don't know. And when you hear them try to describe what we believe, it's usually the most ridiculous caricature. It's a mockery. The regime is completely irrational. The only thing we can do when you're dealing with these people is be aware of what's going on, aware of the roots of their power. Do not lash out. Do not get angry. And simply make sure that you call all this stuff out. They'll use tactics, as we mentioned before. They'll use every possible method to shut us up, to humiliate us. You stay calm. You focus on the central fact at hand and recognize what you're dealing with here. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.